Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look back at the story in the news that defined the struggle between the better angels of our nature and the emerging dark side of America that exploded into the open this year in Charlottesville, Virginia. We'll begin with a broadcast of Background Briefing from August the 13th, 2017, on the violence that was brought to Charlottesville, Virginia by the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis and white nationalist groups under the banner of Unite the Right, who organized a Nazi-like torchlight protest against the removal of a statue of the Confederate leader Robert E. Lee, then converged on the statue wearing military gear. Then the next day converged on the statue wearing military gear, waving Confederate flags and Nazi swastikas chanting, "You will not replace us," and "Jews will not replace us," as they clashed with counter-demonstrators. Nicole Hemmer, a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, joined us to discuss her article at U.S. News and World Report, Sounds and Silence in Charlottesville as the violence of white nationalism spilled onto the streets of Virginia, and what she witnessed after a car driven by a white supremacist plowed into a crowd of demonstrators celebrating the dispersal of the Unite the Right demonstrators. Then we'll go to our broadcast from August the 14th, 2017, following the grudging acceptance by Donald Trump of the need to condemn Saturday's violence by neo-Nazi white supremacists in a television address in which he insisted on first emphasizing what a great economy he had created before addressing the burning issue of Charlottesville as if it were an afterthought. A witness who was part of the interfaith protest by clergy who faced Saturday's phalanx of heavily armed and white supremacist stormtroopers spewing racist hatred, Brian Mann, joined us. He's in his sixth year of studies at the Rabbinical School of Hebrew College in Boston and will be an ordained rabbi in June of 2018. With his prayer shawl and kippah, linking arms with other clergy led by Cornel West, Brian faced the Nazi taunts of blood and soil and Jews will not replace us, and he described how the police did nothing to protect the counter-protesters who were defended by the Antifa, the anti-fascists who came to their rescue, meeting violence with violence, which has led many, including Trump, to assign blame to many sides. Then finally, we'll go to the August 15th broadcast of Background Briefing for the extraordinary reopening of the self-inflicted wounds by Donald Trump, who reversed his reluctant acknowledgement that neo-Nazis and white supremacists were responsible for the violence in Charlottesville, to blame what he called the alt-left, reviving his inexplicable compulsion to pander to the far-right fringe of his base for reasons that remain unclear unless our president is in fact a racist. Anthony McAleer, board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working to de-radicalize neo-Nazis and white supremacist youth, whose funding grant from the Department of Homeland Security was rescinded by Catherine Gorka, the wife of White House Deputy Sebastian Gorka, who vowed to shut down the DHS Countering Violence Extremism program and shift the funds away from white supremacist domestic terrorism to target American Muslims, along with getting his wife a job. From a former member of WAR, the White Aryan Resistance, we'll learn about the mainstreaming of white racism today away from tattooed skinheads to clean-cut people in suits such as Richard Spencer, who look like our neighbors. And joining us now is Nicole Hemmer, a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and a research associate at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney. She is host of the Past Present podcast and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics, and a contributor to U.S. News and World Report, where her latest article is Sounds and Silence in Charlottesville: The Violence of White Nationalism Spilled onto the Streets of Virginia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicole Hemmer.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And Nicole, your normally peaceful town, where there's a campus, a large campus at which you teach, the University of Virginia, was clearly invaded or disrupted by a alt-right neo-Nazi white nationalist group who organized protests of the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, and they brought with them violence. Surely, I mean, the president's response is so troubling to so many people that you, just tell us what you witnessed, because it seems pretty clear that that nobody would have died and been injured had this white supremacist rally not happened.
Certainly. I mean, there have been white supremacist rallies in Charlottesville over the course of the last year over this issue of the removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee, and then the broader issue of white nationalism and the continued dominance of white people in Charlottesville politics and American politics. And by the time that I had gotten to the rally yesterday, the rally was supposed to start at noon. I arrived about an hour beforehand, and it had already devolved into a considerable amount of violence. People throwing things, including things that were on fire, pepper spray, all of these sorts of things, people fighting. And that was already happening by 11, and in fact had really gotten its start the night before when there was an unauthorized torchlit rally through the campus of the University of Virginia, where members of the alt-right set upon some students who were counter-protesting an anti-racist protest at the statue of Thomas Jefferson, in which several students were attacked by members of the alt-right. So this had already become violent the night before, and I think that by the time everyone started gathering on Saturday, it was clear that trouble was in the air.
Well, what you wrote about in your article, U.S. News and World Report, is pretty alarming, the way you witnessed these white supremacist neo-Nazis beating up a young black man with sticks and clubs, and they had shields, had military equipment. Many of them had body armor and were carrying assault rifles. And this happened right in front of the police station. So to what extent were the police allowing this violence to happen, or somehow being complicit?
Yeah, this is the thing that was perhaps most shocking to me. It first started at Emancipation Park, where the protesters and the white nationalist group were facing off with one another. There were violent clashes that were happening already in the morning, and police weren't intervening. And then as the white nationalists began to march down Market Street here in downtown Charlottesville, they began to clash with anti-racist protesters, where I was right outside of a police station in Charlottesville on that street near a parking garage. I watched as a young man was beaten by white nationalists, and there simply wasn't any intervention by the police. And it was one of those things that I don't know if there was a broader theory of crowd control that was going on behind it, but up until the attack by the car later on that afternoon, it was the most violent thing that I had seen, and there was no intervention, which was shocking. I mean, there were so many members of the National Guard, of the state police, of the local police that were gathered there, and there wasn't any action by them. And again, I don't know if there was a larger theory that was going on there for why they weren't acting, but it sent the message that they would watch this violence happen but not actually intervene, which I think was disturbing for a lot of people there.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicole Hemmer, who's a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and a research associate at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney. She's the host of Past Present podcast and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, and a contributor to U.S. News and World Report, where she has an article, Sounds and Silence in Charlottesville, the violence of white nationalism spilled onto the streets of Virginia. And of course, the silence I suspect you're referring to is President Trump's response, where he blamed many sides. And that has troubled a lot of people, including a number of Republican senators. But let's talk about the sounds. You were there shortly after the car driven by this young white nationalist member of Vanguard America, James Alex Fields, plowed into a group of protesters who were celebrating the dispersal of the neo-Nazi white nationalists. And this car plowed in at high speed. There's video of it. A 32-year-old young woman from Charlottesville died. 19 people were injured, many of them seriously. It's particularly upsetting. I mean, I have a daughter the same age, so Tell me what happened. The sounds must have been hideous of the aftermath of that act of terrorism. To put it bluntly, that was an act of terrorism. I don't see how it's different from what happened in Nice, where the so-called or at least self-proclaimed or ISIS member of ISIS plowed into a group of revelers in Nice, France.
Well, I think that's what's so stark about this particular attack is that it is so reminiscent of terror attacks that we've seen in Nice and Westminster on London Bridge, and it looked exactly like what we saw after those attacks. There were bodies everywhere. There was blood everywhere. It was something that, I mean, people can look on it online, although I don't recommend that they do, but the aftermath looked like the aftermath of those attacks. And the weapon was the same. The political hostility was there. And so the fact that this hasn't been called by the president or the administration an act of terrorism is, it's not shocking. I mean, it's what we've come to expect. I mean, we've seen terror attacks against mosques in Quebec here in the United States that have elicited no response from the administration. So we know that their use of the word terrorism is political. But here in Charlottesville, where we have such clear evidence of a politically motivated attack that uses the same kind of weaponry that we've seen in other attacks across the world, that language wouldn't be used. Again, it's not surprising, but I think it is telling.
But all of the people that these demonstrators that came to Charlottesville were celebrating, waving their flags, and they were Ku Klux Klansmen. Their history is of absolute horrendous violence. They murdered, burned people alive. The Civil War was the most bloody event in this country's history. More people died per capita than much more in the Civil War than did in any of America's wars by extraordinary factor. I mean, the casualty rate in the Civil War was horrendous. And then you've got these people with swastikas and Nazi paraphernalia celebrating this genocidal murderer, Adolf Hitler. So what the hell are they celebrating? Aren't they celebrating death, destruction, bloodshed, genocide?
Yes, and in defense of white power. I mean, there's no one who could have seen this event and not understood it as a defense of not just white nationalism, but violent white nationalism. I mean, white nationalism has always been violent. It's always taken some form of violence in order to hold together this power dynamic in which white people are on top. But what we saw was a very overt defense of that in a way that I don't think that we've really seen since the 1950s and 1960s in this country, that there is Nazi paraphernalia alongside Confederate paraphernalia. It's a shocking thing to see, but it has become an overt part of our politics, and we can't talk about it as a fringe political movement, because what we are seeing here in Charlottesville is not unconnected from what we're seeing in the White House, right? We see a president who not only was not willing to openly reject white supremacists both during the campaign and now during his administration, but who has surrounded himself with people who have affiliations with Richard Spencer, with the alt-right, and with neo-Nazi movements. And so what's happening here in Charlottesville is not a fringe thing. It's not irrelevant to what's happening in national politics. It's a microcosm of what we're experiencing in national politics. And so people need to pay attention. They need to understand the amount of violence that it took for them to make their case and to understand that that's not just something limited here to Charlottesville.
But when you use the word overt, I mean, it is overt. It used to be covert in the sense that the Ku Klux Klansmen wore hoods. But these people are out there in front of the cameras, courting the cameras, strutting their stuff, proud of their affiliations with the Nazis and with the Confederacy, etc. That's the change. And do you see a connection between the fact that white supremacists in this country now proudly strut their stuff? And that's only happened recently, and it's something of a coincidence that it's happened since the emergence of Donald Trump.
Well, I wouldn't call it a coincidence at all. I think that they've pretty openly acknowledged that they feel freed by Donald Trump. I mean, there was an article in the Daily Stormer, which is a white nationalist neo-Nazi publication, I think just yesterday, where they talked about the statement that Trump made, and they were gloating about it, saying, look, now we finally have a president who's not even going to denounce us, who's going to say that, well, both sides are to blame and not actually call anyone out. And that matters. It matters that you have a president who's not willing to openly denounce the organizations that are involved in these kinds of hate groups and incidents. And certainly the people involved in these groups understand that, and they feel empowered by it. Now, the Klan covered its face. Most white supremacist organizations throughout U.S. history, they haven't covered their faces, right? I mean, you have people like Robert Byrd, who was a U.S. senator and a member of the Ku Klux Klan. So it's not that all white supremacists have covered their faces, but that neo-Nazi groups feel comfortable being out and proud during the administration of Donald Trump is something worth noting. It's not a coincidence.
Well, just in closing, the Antifa, I guess, the other group, they got a lot of press, and they showed up there, or Black Bloc or whatever they are. It's hard to know who these people are. They're very secretive. They do cover their faces with balaclavas, et cetera. And they were involved with riots during the inauguration. They've had the unfortunate effect of equating the neo-Nazis with their form of provocative violence. But it doesn't look as if the people that were mowed down by the car, particularly the young woman from Charlottesville who was killed along with the 19, many of whom are very gravely injured, they weren't a part of the provocateurs in terms of the counter demonstrations.
Right. I mean, I think it's very easy to lump all of these groups together, whereas the folks who were gathered in Emancipation Park were overtly identified with white nationalists. The groups that were counter-protesting, certainly there were anti-fascists involved, and some of those anti-fascists belonged to groups like the Black Bloc, who don't mind using violence in order to make their point. But you also had Black Lives Matter activists, you had members of the clergy, you had people who simply were anti-Nazi, which is not a terribly provocative viewpoint. And then you just had people down on the downtown mall who weren't activists at all. I mean, Charlottesville is a town that brings together a lot of people on a nice sunny weekend afternoon. So you had a broad group of people there, and even among the protesters, a broad group of people, very few of whom were committed to violence as a form of protest. There's been a lot of organization and activism in Charlottesville to determine what's the best way to respond to this. And by and large, the answer has been through nonviolence, but through visible and vocal protests. And that's largely what you saw here in Charlottesville on Saturday. And that it ended with violence was not the responsibility of anti-fascists, but was the responsibility of white nationalists.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nicole Hemmer. I'm sorry that you had to witness such horror and that this whole thing took place. But I do hope that enough decent Americans are able to shame our president into recognizing that he is in bed with ugly people with an extremely ugly history. And it's just shameful.
I join you in that wish.
And again, I mean, speaking with Nicole Hemmer, who's a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and a research associate at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney. She's the host of Past President Podcast and author of Messengers to the Right, of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, and a contributor to U.S. News and World Report, where her latest article is Sounds and Silence in Charlottesville, The Violence of White Nationalism Spilled onto the Streets of Virginia. And that was an interview from Background Briefing from August the 13th, 2017. We'll take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing's alt-right coverage from 2017 with an interview on August the 14th, the day after.